Freedom is back in style. Welcome to the revolution.
We put a boot in your ass. It's the American way.
The new Sean Hannity Show.
Sean Hannity.
More behind the scenes information on breaking news. And more bold, inspired solutions for America.
All right, if you're just joining us, welcome to our news roundup, final hour information overload hour. Before we get to our other stories of the day, reminder, our top story remains how the CBO projected that Obamacare will reduce the total number of hours Americans work by the equivalent of 2.3 million full-time jobs. Anyway, here for our news roundup, information overload hour, we have Horace Cooper is with us. He's an adjunct fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research, co-chair of Project 21, the National Advisory Board, and Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the U.S., professor of history, American studies at Occidental College. Welcome, both. Well, you're a big liberal, Thaddeus, so I assume you like the idea that as soon as we're going to have fewer hours, fewer workers, more people dependent on government, and a disincentive to work because their subsidies will run out. You got to love this as a lib.
God, I don't know where you got your information about me.
Oh! Yo, welcome back to School Sucks. This is part two in our Renegade History course with Thaddeus Russell. Some of you are saying, Brett, we listen to Macklemore on the show now. No, we're going to change that. Hold on 1 second. Don't want to encourage him. Others might be saying, I think Macklemore is just a delightful young man who is rapping and talking about important issues. I don't care for Macklemore, and I'm gonna give you some reasons why. I'm pretty sure Thaddeus isn't really crazy about him either, at least certain aspects of his message. We're going to discuss in the show today an article that Thaddeus wrote for Reason.com. It's called The Progressive Lineage of Macklemore's and Lord's Attacks on the Pleasures of the Poor. And the slug line is, where pop culture, progressives, and puritanical values meet. Now, why don't I like Macklemore, this delightful young man? Well, something was brought to my attention on another show that I listen to from time to time, a comedy podcast called Red Bar Radio. And the host of Red Bar, a guy named Mike, is in the process of making his own rap album. And he has decided that Macklemore is going to be his rap enemy. But a lot of his criticisms are well-founded, in my opinion. So this is basically Mike's assessment of Macklemore. And once I heard this and heard some interviews or some speeches that he gave at award ceremonies, I realized how serious this actually is. Macklemore has, at this point, a pattern of taking entirely uncontroversial stances on issues that are pretty much settled to basically juice applause out of unthinking pop audiences. So Macklemore will stand up and say, I think gay people should be able to get married. People erupt into applause. His popularity is boosted. He did a whole song about this and this really overblown performance at the recent Grammy Awards, where there was actually wedding ceremonies going on in the background while he sang. And I'm going to stop myself right there because I'm afraid this is somebody's first time listening. I'm not coming from any kind of bigoted place if this is your first show. And obviously, I'm not some kind of political opponent of gay marriage. And I will say that if Macklemore had come out with this song in this video, Same Love, that got him, you know, this Grammy performance, the Ellen DeGeneres show, if he had come out with this song in 1990, he would be a badder badass than Eminem. Because in 1990, he would have been a pioneer if he was, you know, putting this message out with this much mainstream appeal. Like, this was not an out-in-the-open issue then. But that was 1990. In 2014, you're not walking into the crashing waves. You're kind of, like, safely body surfing on pretty much widespread public opinion. But there's something else here, too, that's also very important. And it lines up with what Thaddeus Russell was talking about in that Reason article. In the first installment in this series, we talked about Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement and how what the Civil Rights Movement became, especially with the political interventions, people like John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, wasn't about the recognition of a unique black culture. in the United States. It certainly wasn't about the acknowledgement or the respect for the individual liberties of black people. It was about assimilation. It was about conformity. And those two things are very much about somebody else's needs and desires. We see the very same thing with gay rights today. Now, I live in New Hampshire. There's a wonderful place in Massachusetts, believe it or not, called Provincetown. It's on the very northern tip of Cape Cod. Interestingly, this is actually where the Puritans who came here in 1620 crash landed. Right? The whole rock thing in Plymouth made a better story, but their boat ran aground in what became Provincetown, Massachusetts. And what a wonderful FU to the puritanical culture of America if you see what Provincetown is today. A lot of gay men live in Provincetown. So there's other areas in the country too, and it's not just men, of course. Really unique, countercultural, nonconformist environments. Now here in New England, Provincetown is a big attraction. My Republican mom and her Republican mom friends actually venture to Provincetown every Halloween because that's when people really let loose. They dress up in sexually themed costumes to participate in a gay parade. My mom and her friends do this. And then, yes, they come home, they put their costumes away, and they go vote for Mitt Romney. So it's weird, but, you know, it's cool, except for the Romney part. I love the fact that a place like Provincetown exists, that this counterculture exists. And it's an amazing place to be. But when we use terms like gay rights, is it about recognition of that? Is it about respect for that? Appreciation for that? Nope. It's about assimilation. You know, goodbye Provincetown, hello Plymouth. And I don't want to talk about people who are advocating for gay rights as if they're mindless, right? This is not a problem with gay people. What I'm talking about is a problem with schooled people, letting others tell you what you want just because they're in perceived positions of greater power. So what is the great goal of the gay rights movement? You want to be able to get married. Now, obviously, this is a complex issue because the government has attached this pretty comprehensive financial carrots and sticks system to the institution of marriage. So there are legitimate reasons why people would want to get married. There's benefits that you get, you know, hospital visits and so on and so forth. So the progressives, the liberals, Thaddeus Russell's, you know, primary target in a lot of his work, say, hey, look, you've got an ally in us. All you've got to do is come out once a year and vote for our politicians, and we're on your side. We're in your corner. Oh, as long as this is what you want. Oh, that is what you want because you've been absorbing political narratives and pop culture and mainstream media. And lucky us, you believe that these are your values and these are your goals. Because I've talked to a lot of gay people who aren't even libertarians. It's not some great ambition of theirs to get married, but this is what people perceive, that all will be settled, everything will be equal when gay people can get married. So I see Macklemore as a perpetuator of this idea, but also identifying what people's needs are, what people's desires are, and then using that against them. Maybe he doesn't realize that he's doing it. I mean, like I said, I first heard about the Macklemore problem on Red Bar Radio, and I don't think I'm as cynical as the host of that show, Mike, is about Macklemore. You know, I don't think this is some kind of image design. It could be, but I mean, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But I do find it bothersome whenever I can observe, you know, this process of people being labeled and then corralled and told what they want. Or told what they should want by politicians or academia or intellectuals or the auxiliary forces of those groups in the entertainment industry who often, you know, carry that out without really even knowing what they're doing. And we talked a lot on the show in the past about these parades of popular movement or popular sentiment. And the people who hold power, the people who benefit from things as they are now, if they can't stop the parade, they jump in front of it. Then they pretend to be leading it. And when you're in that position of the front of the parade, it's very easy to change its route. You know, there's a long history of that happening. People changing parade routes and motorcade routes. Ooh, don't go there. So bottom line, the smallest and most oppressed minority in the United States over the course of the last century is one that politicians and shapers of public opinion and those who benefit from the shaping of public opinion rarely acknowledge and never cater to. And I'm talking, of course, about the individual. And it makes sense that the very idea of individualism is one that these people would want to avoid, because individuals are smart and capable of detecting bullshit. Groups, on the other hand, are dumb and make themselves easy targets for bullshit. By the way, big shout out to Security Moms, a real voting bloc identified by Republican pollsters. So anyway, you know, I don't know if Thaddeus Russell would endorse everything I just said, but I appreciate his work for getting me thinking in new ways. It's been a really valuable experience. So let's get into this show. The purpose of the discussion before it began was to go through the lenses through which we can view history. And we've talked a little bit about this on the show before. The great man theory, the trends and forces theory, revisionist history, cultural history. Because we open the show after we talk about his appearance on Hannity, because we had to bump back our recording time because he had this opportunity to be on Sean Hannity's radio show. I will put the entire Sean Hannity discussion at the end of today's transmission. It is pretty torturous, though. You can listen if you want. So we spent a few minutes talking about that. Then we move into this Reason article, and we spend a lot of time talking about cultural criticism and the cultural lens of history and its importance. We do sneak in some discussion about other lenses towards the end of the show. So also, still waiting for your feedback. Do you have comments? Do you have questions? Do you have objections to anything that you've heard in the series so far? Please go to schoolsucksproject.com, find the pages for these episodes, leave your comments and questions, and I can work them into future shows. And a final note, if you can avoid listening with headphones, I recommend it. There's kind of this low-end whooshing sound that had something to do with Skype. I'm sorry. I'm done experimenting. In fact, I'm done messing around, folks. I'm about to invest a considerable amount of money in a new supercomputer that will allow us to do Skype and Ustream and audio recording and playing videos on YouTube simultaneously. And I've got a meeting in about an hour with our friend Tony Myers, who's going to give me some guidance on that project. So, sorry, these are problems that I'm working out, and they will be resolved soon. All right, everyone, thanks for listening. Take care. Let's get right into it. You just did a pre-taped with Hannity?
Yeah, it's airing 5 o'clock Eastern time.
Yeah, how did that go?
On radio, not his radio show, not the TV show.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just... It's a circus.
What did he want to do with you?
They saw me on Stossel, and for some reason his producer liked me and thought I was good. I don't know. So I get on and he says, well, so we have a big liberal on this show. Thaddeus, you're a big liberal, so you must love this, the entitlements. And so, you know, when it starts there, kind of have to clear a lot of brush to start talking. And by then the show's over, you know what I mean? So it's just, whatever, I scored a couple points, but, you know, just pure rhetorical. You don't have time to really make any arguments. And since he's yelling at you, and I was on with another, like, right-winger who was also going off, I mean, you can't really establish any arguments that are going to be persuasive. You just have to make good sort of rhetorical points, which a couple times I did, you know.
Zingers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if there happened to be, like, 5 or 10 listeners who were at all sympathetic to anarchism or left libertarianism, they would totally dig it, but I don't even know if that's his demographic. I mean, if there's anybody like that who listens to him. Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? Whatever. It was it's Hannity. It was like 20 minutes and the three of us also, and we covered like 5 news items, and it was ridiculous.
Yeah, so typical, par for the course, right? Like lots of talking and minimal amounts of information.
Yeah, I mean, you know how it's that style, that AM conservative radio style, which is just a lot of shouting and not much substance. So, and you know, and the thing is, it's sort of like, I don't bother with conservatives generally.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's like arguing, it's like an atheist arguing with a Christian. I mean, you can't, what are you going to do? I mean, there's nothing, there's sort of fundamental values at odds here. Whereas with liberals, you know, they purport to share my values, but then that, and then sort of demonstrate that they don't actually, that their arguments, that their politics don't support those values.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as with a conservative, it's sort of like, well, let's just agree to disagree. I mean, you think that there should be, you know, a powerful state government that controls people's intimate lives, and you think that we should kill all the Arabs in the world until before they can kill us. And, you know, I mean, and the flag is a wonder. We talked about the flag that came up, and, you know, they think the flag and the nation are things that should be revered the way we revere God. And what are you going to do about that? I mean, the only thing I could do is sort of latch on to the founding fathers, because they sort of, you know, they pay allegiance to the founding fathers. And I say, well, you know, Jefferson and Madison and the rest of them said we should be sort of perpetually hostile to government, because they understood that government is inimical to our individual freedom, you know. And of course, Hannity was like, whoa, but Jefferson was the president, you know. I mean, so that was it. I mean, and then we moved on to another topic. So, you know, it's not, I mean, you're from a very different place than I'm from. I mean, I've never, those people are like exotic zoo animals to me. I don't, you know, when you grow up in Berkeley and then go to Antioch and then live in Manhattan and then Los Angeles, you're just not around. And in academia, you're just almost never around anyone who thinks that way. I mean, I don't think I know anyone who votes Republican. Certainly no one I consider to be a friend. So it's all of my energy is devoted to subverting liberalism, which runs my world.
All right. Let's do that with this story that I wanted to open with. I don't know what I was expecting when you got on. I didn't know if you were going to be all charged up and furious from this experience. I was trying, why would Hannity see your work and want to expose anyone to you? Was confusing to me. So I was very looking forward to.
Well, he has lefties on all the time, right?
Yeah. So he kind of pigeonholed you.
He thought I was that. He thought I was going to be, you know, some liberal Democrat, which is who he usually shouts at.
Oh, okay, sure. And you're kind of shitting on, what do they call it, family values?
Yeah, well, we didn't get into that stuff really, but it was more about the theme of it was kind of the individual's relation. Well, this is how an academic would put it, the individual's relationship to the nation state. And mm-hmm. So he was all about, you know, conservatives aren't calling for the execution of Obama. Conservatives believe, or I believe, that, you know, we need to protect the president. That's the most important thing we can do. And the flag is so important, and we should never desecrate the flag. And, you know, so it's kind of like, well, I mean, I sort of said, you know, merging one's identity with the nation state has been a hallmark of totalitarian societies for a long, long time. So the further we go in that direction, the less freedom we have. Sean, I thought conservatives like you were for individual liberty. I suppose that's a point scored. I mean, didn't react to it as if it was. I mean, I joked with them. I kept saying, you know, so I have converted you by the end of it, because we talked about, I guess there was some ruling by a judge somewhere in the Midwest about people. He said it was legal for drivers to flash their lights at other drivers who were about to be caught by traffic cameras.
Yeah, yeah. I just heard this story.
Okay, so yeah, that came up. And so he was like, I think that's great. And I was like, yes, we agree. And I said, I guess I've converted you to being a left libertarian.
Did you happen to get the word anti-statist into the discussion?
No, because that would just sort of be like just too exotic for them, right? I mean, that just sort of, in arguments like this, you have to find some sort of wedge. You have to find something.
Yeah.
Some agreement, right? You have to find some agreement. And then from there, you can then show that if they agree with this point, then they should agree with this other point. So if they agree that the state should not have the right to take pictures of us at stoplights, then, you know, I mean, that to me, that's sort of like, in other words, if you identify with the nation state, which he calls for,
yeah,
then you should, when you drive up to a stoplight, you should be happy that there are cameras there. You should be happy. You should be happy that the state's looking at us all the time, because, hey, if that's who we are, if we are America, the United States, not America, the United States, if that's who we are, then sure, because they're our dad. They're part of, we're all one family, right?
Yeah. That's
America, the United States is a family.
It sounds nice.
Yeah. So no, I mean, so that's, I didn't get a chance to say that, but I mean, I should have, you know, if I had had more than 2.5 seconds to respond to this thing, I would have said that, sure. I mean, if you pay allegiance to the United States and you give yourself over like a soldier does, meaning your entire life, which of course he paid homage to all the veterans who have died in our wars to make us free, which I didn't get a chance to respond to, then hey, why not? I mean, cameras should be everywhere, right?
So you lead them down a road called consistency and hope they don't pump the brakes on you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right. It's identifying logical inconsistencies. But it's more about taking their purported values and then demonstrating that their arguments and their politics actually run contrary to those values.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, well, I mean, I guess if anything, before we move on, you picked a good time to talk with somebody like Sean Hannity because they're out of power. So these words like freedom, right, and liberty and constitution get entered into their vocabulary. When they're back in power, all those words are replaced with a word like security or Mexicans.
Right. Or insecurity and Mexicans, which of course are synonymous in their minds.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, right. So that's, I mean, that, and so I do, but I spend most of my time doing that with liberals and socialists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or all my time, really. And of course, one of the things that annoys me tremendously is that the people in my world spend most of their time talking about how stupid Sean Hannity is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the dichotomy they see. I talked about this recently on a podcast. Salon has this theme recurring on that website, recovered libertarians who've seen the light of liberalism and found their way to the adults table of politics, so to speak. And they talk about their stories. So the exact same kind of thing where they see this dichotomy between people on the right, like Sean Hannity or the congressman who uses words like legitimate rape. And they say, well, there's only two choices in American politics. One choice is Sean Hannity and the legitimate rape guy and the guy who brings up the Noah's Ark to talk about global warming. And then there's us. So we must be the smart ones. And right. Unfortunately, that's terribly deceiving.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of problems with that. I mean, one is that they are out of power, that their guy is in power. It's their guy who's, you know, bombing people. It's their guy who's putting people in prison. It's their guy who's deporting people. And so why are we focused on Sean Hannity exactly?
Sure. Right. Right. So
that's one problem with it. The other is it's easy. Because, yes, they're not intellectuals. You know, we're not talking about Plato here when we're talking about Sarah Palin. No kidding. She's stupid. Third is that, yes, they're stupid, but to go on and on about how stupid they are is elitist. Rather, I just ignore them.
I mean,
so it's like what I say to them is, you know, you wonder why there's so much hostility to the bi-coastal liberal elite when you're talking about the way that Sarah Palin speaks and dresses, really? I mean, and the makeup she wears? I mean, no kidding. No wonder they hate your guts. You know, in fact, I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, it's really, really elitist.
Yeah.
Which dovetails with something I talk about a lot, which is sort of liberal and left-wing hostility to pop culture. Right.
Yeah. So this was our big transition here into another group of people that you upset this week, aside from poor Sean Hannity's audience. You wrote a piece this week for Reason, the progressive lineage of Macklemore's and Lord's attacks on the pleasures of the poor. This didn't go over very well.
Well, yes and no. I mean, so it was the most viewed article on reason.com for about 5 days.
Yeah.
It was liked on Facebook, I think 4,000 times, and posted on Twitter about 200, or tweeted about 200 times. But also, it was, if you look at the Reason Facebook page and if you look at the comments under it on reason.com, it is this avalanche of invective against me for writing this piece. So the argument for those of you who don't know, I mean, is that Macklemore and Lord, and this is pretty uncontroversial. I mean, I think there's wide agreement that they are attacking the conspicuous consumption that's celebrated in hip hop. I mean, I have quotes from Macklemore and Lord themselves saying that. I mean, that's pretty much accepted. What I do is I show that they are very, very similar in doing that to early progressives from the early 20th century who were relentless critics of conspicuous consumption among the poor, mm-hmm. and went so far as to call for austerity budgets for working class Americans, which made it would have made it impossible for them to buy anything beyond bare subsistence. So it's there's this very long lineage of elite bourgeois do-gooders who purport to speak on behalf of and for the poor and the working class, who are hostile to what capitalism has given them, which is access to luxury goods that was impossible before the rise of industrial capitalism.
You know, I feel like I really internalized this idea too. I mean, I came like you, I came from maybe more a traditional left position. And I remember at Liberty Forum, we had like a minor disagreement over Edward Bernays and his role in public relations. And I remember when I first saw The Century of the Self, the Adam Curtis film. Have you seen that?
No, but I know about it. I remember our discussion about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he said, Curtis in the film says, Bernays got people to want things they didn't need. And I saw the film maybe like 2005 and I was like, wow, that's fucked up. He made people want things they didn't need. So I had very much kind of internalized, I guess, what is, you know, something that's encouraged by that side, a kind of self-denial.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a whole chapter on this. It's a very common left-wing argument about advertising, mm-hmm. and marketing, right? They convince us to want things we wouldn't otherwise want, you know? So there's a bunch of problems with that argument. First of all, it's again quite elitist and quite disdainful of toward the intelligence of ordinary Americans. If we're that stupid that any advertiser can convince me to want something that might even be bad for me or that I wouldn't want otherwise, my God, I'm an idiot. Second of all, it's simply false. If you look at the history of advertising and capitalism and consumer products, the vast, vast, vast majority, of course, of consumer products have failed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Including ones that have been marketed massively. Hollywood movies, right? How much marketing goes into Hollywood movies and how many of them fail? About 90%. 90% of Hollywood movies fail, lose money, even though they are splashed on billboards and across our TV screens and everywhere we go, we see advertisements for Hollywood movies, yet most of the time we don't go see those movies.
Right.
Well, gee. Why is that? And then you look at the history of the automobile industry. Many, many, many heavily marketed automobiles that came from Ford and Chrysler and GM also failed. The Edsel, the Studebaker, on and on and on and on, right? Mm-hmm. Massive advertising campaigns and people didn't buy the cars. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that, and this is actually, by the way, Mises. I mean, he has this awesome quote that someone just sent me, which I didn't know about until the Macklemore piece came out, where Mises basically makes the argument, which I think is known. The argument is, I think it's known as consumer sovereignty. He makes the argument that consumers rule the marketplace, that they essentially make all the decisions. They force producers, capitalists, to give them what they want, which makes perfect sense to me. Well, I mean, so I actually moonlighted for a minute in consumer market research and, you know, found out that increasingly over the last 50 to 60 years, much of the marketing budgets by major corporations has gone toward not advertising, but research to find out what we want, what consumers want. And they kill themselves trying to find out what consumers want, not just throwing any old product up on the screen and assuming we're so dumb we will then want it, right?
Yeah. Well, let me throw this in there, and this kind of fits into my whole schooling versus education thing. And I've been having kind of a shitty thought for several weeks now, and maybe you can talk me out of it. And I say it's shitty because it makes me feel like an elitist. The fact that over 95% of the population spends 15,000 hours in institutions that do not train them in critical thinking has created significant distortions in what we call the market and what we call consumer behavior. If you walk into a convenience store and, you know, pick up any food item, it's filled with things that are not food, you know, and people say, well, you know, the people who put this in a bag know more about making food, so it must be okay for me to eat. You know, and stuff like that. I mean, most of the things that are popular, and again, like I'm somewhat apologetic here because it does make me feel like an elitist. I just say, what the hell is wrong with people? Why do they like this? Why are they getting pleasure from this? And I think like that's an effective schooling, and I think it's something that people can educate themselves out of.
Okay, so here's the main argument against that.
Okay.
So schools, compulsory schools, which mm-hmm. you and I hate more than anyone, have been run overwhelmingly by whom for the last 120 some years?
Like the progressives. Yeah.
Right. They have preached not that we should eat potato chips, but that we should eat good, healthy foods that make us vigorous workers.
Oh, damn. Yep.
Duh. they go to a public school right now. What do you think they're preaching? They're preaching good, healthy food, so because it'll give you energy when you get up in the morning. Go to your fucking cubicle. It doesn't make any sense to me. Sorry.
No, that's you're so. It's like an argument that I've made 100 times and just couldn't fit into this discussion. Sometimes, like, it's almost like saying, "Gosh, you know, in a society where we're all forced to attend gym class for 12 years, why are so many people fat?" It's right. A stupid question.
Okay, have we talked about the cultural contradictions of capitalism?
I don't believe so. No.
Daniel Bell thesis?
No, not together. No.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, this is crucial. So, Daniel Bell, major sociologist who died about 5 years ago, part of the so-called New York intellectuals of the 50s and 60s, wrote this very important essay, which was built into a book, came out in 73, I think, called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, in which Bell argued, and I'm persuaded by this, that capitalism produces two contradictory cultural impulses, or two contradictory cultures. One is the culture of production and work and discipline, right? Mm-hmm. It requires you to regulate. Actually, I said this in New Hampshire when I was there in my talk there, which you were at. So this will be familiar to you.
Okay.
It requires the what I call the machinification of the human body, right? You got to get up the same time every morning and go to work at the same time every day. You got to leave at the same time every day. You got to sit in your cubicle all day long acting like a machine. It requires that. Capitalism requires that. There's no question about that. So there's this, and out of that flows this culture that celebrates the Puritan work ethic.
Okay.
All right. So Max Weber said that. Who would deny it? If you look at our formal culture, in other words, what politicians and businessmen and our teachers preach, it is the work ethic, right? And discipline. That's what schools are for, right? So that's Horace Mann. That's John Dewey. That's our compulsory schools. That's what they do to our children. They discipline them. They train them to assimilate into that half of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
that culture that is part of capitalism. So here's the awesome, amazing, crazy, wonderful thing about capitalism, though. Simultaneously, at the very same time, what we produce from our cubicles and from the factories are things that radically, aggressively, relentlessly subvert discipline, the Puritan work ethic, the nuclear family ethic, the anti-sex ethic. It's hedonism. It produces pure hedonism, right? So it's the system that is probably unique in world history. It's a system that fights itself.
Yeah, because it's hedonism plus time and labor saving devices and equipment.
Right. So it's the fancy word is it's dialectical. There is an intrinsic contradiction, a conflict, it's an eternal, it's a constant. What I love about it is that it's an eternal struggle. It will always happen. With capitalism, capitalists will always want to produce things that appeal to our desire, our base desires, because they make money through that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why there are, you know, that's why there's a huge alcohol industry and a huge pornography industry and a huge hamburger industry and a huge, you know, on and on and on, right? Because it makes money. But the workers that they employ to make those things must be disciplined. They can't be drinking the whiskey and watching the porn. So I say to my, I tell my students this a lot. It's true. I just moved, but until about 6 months ago, I lived, this is true, about five blocks from the world headquarters of the Girls Gone Wild.
Yep.
And I happened to know a guy who worked there, you know, as I was joking with him, I was like, oh, so what are the offices like at Girls Gone Wild? He's like, well, it's a bunch of cubicles and people quietly working all day long. You know, it's like, oh, really? No kidding. It's not like hot tubs with chicks in bikinis and people doing coke.
Yep.
Lines of coke off the tops of their Macintosh computers. No, it sucks. It's just, you know, drudgery and boredom all day long. I said, no, of course it is, right? But what they're so that's the productive disciplinary side. But it's what they're producing, of course, is like a full-scale assault on Puritanism. So Daniel Bell identified these two cultures that capitalism produces as, he called them Puritanism and Hedonism. It's producing both those cultures simultaneously, and those two cultures fight against each other. This is what I love about capitalism. They fight against each other all the time. It's a tremendously dynamic culture. It's not static like socialism.
Interesting. So it's thesis, antithesis.
Oh, so to connect this back to our original point.
Sure.
Political leaders, businessmen, teachers publicly have to promote the puritanical side of capitalism. That's their job.
Yeah.
They're the managers of society, of capitalism, of a capitalist society. Progressives have loved the puritanical disciplining side of capitalism. They love that. And that's what schools were intended to support from the beginning. That's Horace Mann, right? That's what he was about. He was about training children to be workers.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's what they're, so they've always been about that. And then, but the thing about progressives, and this is what my article was about, they have always hated the hedonistic side of capitalism.
Indeed, yeah.
Right? While, of course, the vast, vast, vast majority of ordinary working class people have loved the hedonism. Of course, because they spend their money voluntarily and their time voluntarily on it, on consuming it. It's hard to argue against that, right? So if you like the stuff that's pleasurable, that people like, that the capitalism produces, you know, whose side are you on? I mean, whose side are you on in this, progressives? You know, they claim to be on the side of the working class. No, I don't think so. I think the people have voted with their feet in huge numbers against progressivism in that way. They vote with their feet against progressivism by turning on the Super Bowl, by liking the commercials in the Super Bowl, by buying the products that are pitched to us during the Super Bowl. They have voted with their feet against that progressive puritanical allegiance to capitalism since the beginning, since the 19th century, when capitalism began producing items of luxury that working class people could afford. It was a revolution in the way that ordinary, not just ordinary, poor people lived. For the first time in human history, poor people could afford access to luxury goods.
Mm-hmm.
They ate ice cream. They drank cold beer. They went to movies. They rode on trains. They went to Coney Island. They wore clothes that were produced not by themselves on a farm,
right,
but were in a factory somewhere else, that were designed, here's a big thing, that were designed just to make you attractive, not for utilitarian purposes alone, right? Before then, you made your own clothes, and because you were poor and they took time and effort, you just made clothes that just kept you warm, served to serve a function. Now, ordinary working class people could buy clothes that were made by other people that made them attractive. That was their intent. That was their purpose, was to make them attractive. I think that's one of the greatest things that's ever happened in human history. I think that's a wonderful thing. So you know what it was called by progressives at the time, and by many, and by conservatives too?
What?
It was called people living above their station.
Yeah, you know, when I first started looking into the history of education in this country, and I said, why the hell are industrial capitalists funding John Dewey's projects at Columbia University? You just provided a very complete, or at least one very complete answer to that question.
They are caught in the middle of that contradiction between Puritanism and hedonism, right? Mm-hmm. They need their workers to be as disciplined as, you know, little Maoists.
Right.
They do, right? I mean, that's why they love uniforms for their workers. They love that. They love, you know, regularized motion. They love making people into little machines. They need that. I mean, it's not because they're evil. It's because the system requires it. But simultaneously, they got to sell products that make people want to have sex and drink whiskey. Capitalists are always in this very tricky situation.
So you actually use the expression formal culture. What it seems like is that we have, as far as what most history presents, is a kind of truth by consensus.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, people call those paradigms. I don't, that's, you know, not my favorite word, but
right.
I think it applies here. So history is written by a consensus of the time, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at high school history textbooks, which are a good indicator of what the consensus is at any one time,
mm-hmm.
if you look at high school history textbooks until the 1960s, you know, slavery was a beneficent institution that trained black people to be civilized.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually one of its purposes, according to that consensus.
Right.
Then the 1960s overthrew that, of course, with a new paradigm. And there was general agreement that slavery was tyrannical, that slaves had no power whatsoever, that whippings and rapes were constant. Now, there were definitely dissenters at the time with that, who I have built upon. But anyway, that it was a totalitarian system. So that was dominant, and that's still pretty dominant. But now there's this shift in the way we've been looking at slavery. I think I'm the first one to sort of forefront that new view of slavery. And I'm certainly the first one to sort of state what is pretty clear from the evidence that's been pulled up in the last 40 or so years, which we can talk about later. But I mean, yeah, there's a cultural consensus that writes history. And that's all dependent on the politics of the time. This is all very Gramscian, by the way, Antonio Gramsci, which I never speak like a Gramscian, but this, in this, it sort of makes sense.
In the simplest terms, the way I've described it before is it basically seems like history is always this agreement, this handshake between the people who want to shape perceptions of society and the people who don't defend themselves intellectually from those people who are trying to shape perception or shape society. So looking at history through a cultural lens, which there is a real lack of from what I've seen, really allows us to see a clearer picture of what the past actually looked like.
Yeah. So you're talking about popular culture and history now?
Yeah, absolutely. I just always explained it to my students and on my shows. It's like, you know, the way you film a movie, it's a very simplistic explanation, but I like it. You can control the amount of light that goes into places. You can control how the camera height, the angle, and through those choices on a film set, you can tell dramatically different stories about the same scene. And, you know, these lenses of history seem to be able to accomplish the same thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the first thing I say is there's no such thing as a true history. Mm-hmm. I mean, always be at least skeptical toward people who claim to be speaking the truth about anything.
Yeah.
I'm a postmodernist, post-structuralist in that way. I mean, I think everything's relative. You know, I never claim that my history is more true or more real or more accurate or more objectively true than any other history. there is plenty of evidence to support pretty much any thesis on history. You know, there is plenty of evidence, has been plenty of evidence to write a book depicting slavery as a wonderful school to train the savage Africans. You know, I mean, we have hundreds and hundreds of interviews with slaves and ex-slaves saying just that. They were happy. They were happy to be on the plantation. The master trained them, taught them well, and treated them well. We also have lots and lots of evidence of masters whipping the living shit out of slaves and treating them like animals, and slaves running away, and slaves fighting their overseers and sometimes killing them. And, you know, I mean, there's a mix.
Yeah.
What is true is what the cultural ruling class of the time determines to be true. That's basically what Gramsci was talking about. His term for it was cultural hegemony. Whoever the ruling class is of the time writes history determines what truth is.
Yeah, right. Like, so, the old saying that it's the winners, right?
Yeah, sure. But I guess one of the things that makes me crazy is that there are people who understand that well, who are in my world, meaning academia, who understand it well, but still sort of claim that their history is the objectively true one.
Yeah, and it's in both of these most, what I would say are the most popular lenses or historical schools of thought. The first one, and in my opinion, the most dangerous one, the great man theory or great man lens of history. And the second one that kind of replaced it in the 60s, as you mentioned, was the revisionist theory. So what it looks like to me is that the momentum of cultural change was always something that rested with the people. And the way I've described it before is usually politicians see a parade coming. At first they say, well, all right, sick dogs on it, shoot tear gas at it. It's still coming. Okay, well, let's jump in front of it and pretend we're leading it. And it's kind of like, whether we're talking about either one of those lenses, the great man or the revisionist, what's happening in your book that I found was so unique that I couldn't find anywhere else, is kind of like you're stealing the parade out from behind the people who jumped in front of it and giving a different, maybe I don't want to say what really happened, but a different perspective from what we've been offered.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Hegelian in this way. It's funny to be throwing all these philosopher names around, but in that, you know, he believed that essentially culture and ideas made history. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's where I stand. And so, which it frustrates a lot of people because they always ask, well, what's the, you know, why did that culture become popular? Why did those ideas become popular at a particular time? And that you can never really, you know, you can't really prove why. I mean, Marxists try to do it. They're materialists. They're anti-Hegelians. They try to do this by tying ideas to what they call material conditions, usually economics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have seen economic depressions move toward fascism, move toward communism, move toward social democracy, move toward anarchism, move toward, you know, all kinds of things. We've seen very advanced, technologically advanced, relatively wealthy countries move toward fascism, move toward, right, move toward communism, move on all sorts of ways. So it's really, I've never found a pattern that can predict. I've never found any sort of cause consistent over time. I've never found a way to find a cause of cultural movements. I've never found a way to sort of identify why. I think that material conditions can contribute to particular ideas, but even there it's tricky. I mean, like, yes, I think that fascism certainly was helped by the depression in the 1920s and 30s, in Europe.
Sure.
But then again, it also helped communism, which is a sort of, you know, you can argue it's a variant of fascism, but it's different in some ways. And it also caused the Weimar Republic to rise. I mean, which was, you know, one of the most liberated cultures in world history, right? I mean, so you look at Germany during the Depression, it had all sorts of contradictory cultures in it that were thriving, you know, very authoritarian cultures and very liberatory ones. And it's hard to predict. So,
it's interesting, though. You mentioned Hegel, and my audience is familiar with Hegel because he's a central figure in German idealism. And one of the arguments we've made on this show before is that that was, you know, a sort of self-sacrificial philosophy in many ways that was delivered here in the 20th century. And another one of Hegel's ideas that actually I think Nietzsche gets a lot of credit for is the superman, you know, the one man who has the power to change things.
Yeah, so I was going to say that, you know, I was actually thinking about the great man thesis lately. I'm not entirely hostile to it. I mean, meaning that since I believe that ideas create history, right?
Yeah.
The producers of ideas are very important, right? And producers of ideas have often been so-called great men, you know. I mean, Marx, there's a good one, right? I mean, so he had this set of ideas that really changed the history of the 20th century, I mean, in real ways. You could say that, you can certainly argue that his ideas were bastardized by the Soviets, etc. But, you know, there's no question that millions and millions and millions of people shaped their lives, shaped their country, shaped the world according to the ideas of one man. Karl Marx. So now, then again, Karl Marx didn't make history. Those masses of people had to actuate those ideas. So they're the ones who made the history. So it's still, I guess I still am basically a social historian in that way too.
Yeah, absolutely. And
you don't want to ever sort of denigrate. What I can't stand is when people say, oh, you're just an academic, you're just writing books, you're just talking on television or whatever it is, you know, you're not changing anything. What you should do is be an activist. I'm like, are you kidding me? So if Karl Marx had spent all of his time being a union organizer, would he have changed the world more than he did as Karl Marx the philosopher? Are you serious?
Projecting an actual message. Yeah. Right.
Yes, of course, right. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Anyway, I'm a cultural determinist, which, you know, always begs the question, and I admit to that. It's like, yeah, I can't tell you why exactly limited democracy took hold in the United States in the 18th century. I mean, I don't know. why then? I mean, I can, you know, it's why here and why then? I don't know.
Okay, let's just return to the great man theory for a minute. I started to realize the dangers, the potential dangers. And I understand that when we're talking about great men, we're not necessarily talking about, you know, if you knew Karl Marx, he was just the sweetest man. You know, he was very special.
I'm not talking about good men.
We're talking about great in impact, even though they're one person.
Important, not good. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But then another historian came along in the 20th century that we talked about when we were preparing for our series here that I was introduced to. I'll actually tell you a story. First of all, the woman's name is Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Yeah.
I met her in Los Angeles in 1992 in a limousine.
Wow.
And that sounds like a story of a very pretentious man, but I was 12. No, I was 14. And we were going to a wedding. She was a friend of my uncle's. My uncle.
Wait a second, Brett. You know, you see what you just did?
What?
The pretentious thing, limousine. See what you just did?
What did I do?
What's wrong with limousines, man?
Because I'm in it with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were saying something bad about limousines.
No, man. Limousines are awesome, and it would be a great story that I'd be telling everyone, you know, if I was in it with...
Don't be a progressive elitist.
No, it's only pretentious because who the other passengers are.
Okay, that's fine.
So we're going to a wedding. It's my uncle's wedding. My uncle is a film producer, and he had done a movie called The Quiz Show, in which Doris Kearns Goodwin's husband, Richard Goodwin, was actually a central character. So he was friends with them, and the two of them are in the limousine sitting across from me, a 12-year-old boy who, you know, doesn't know, or 14, I'm sorry, who doesn't know who they are and doesn't care who they are. And, you know, she seemed like a lovely woman. So... after this experience, Doris Kearns Goodwin became friends with my mom and started sending her books.
Wow.
And I guess, you know, it was as I was waking up and leaving the left and the traditional revisionist college presentation of history, I looked over at my, I was at my mom's one night, and I looked over at her bookshelf, and I was starting to, you know, as I was starting to become more of a libertarian and seeing history through a different lens, I said, holy shit, look at this lineup of books. One's about LBJ, the next one was about Lincoln, and the next one was about FDR. I was like, that's a lot of bodies, you know, those three names are responsible for. But she doesn't do the great man theory in, like, their impact was great. She does it in, like, these people are great men. And I see that as kind of dangerous.
Yeah, so there's two things. There's being descriptive and there's being normative. So she's both. So what I would, you know, you can argue that particular individuals shape history more than others. Okay? That's fine. We can argue that. It's not, there's nothing necessarily bad about that. I'm sympathetic to that argument. I think Marx did shape history more than most people, right? I think Hitler shapes history more than most people. I think FDR, right? All these, that's a description or an analysis. She does that for one. So she buys into that entirely. You know, it's the presidents who made American history. The presidents made American history, by the way, which is, was the dominant historiography of the United States through the 20th century. And it's still pretty powerful. I mean, if you still, I think if you look at most of the production of historians of the U.S., even recently, presidents are kind of central in the narrative. I mean, that's...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, chapters are organized by presidential administrations.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the textbooks. I mean, that is... Now, I have to say, of course, the rise of social history since the 1960s has absolutely challenged that. And there are many, 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 many historians who totally reject that. But I think that sort of in the most respectable establishment mainstream history, it's still, yeah, organized by presidents, presidential administrations. She's doing that. She's saying presidents made history. That's a description or an analysis. But she's also normative about it. The presidents were good. You know, I mean, no, she's what is called a court historian. I mean, she's writing history both within the establishment and on behalf of the establishment. She is of the establishment, right? That's her world. She's always been in that world. She writes from inside that culture. She looks at the world from inside Washington, D.C., outward. So, you know, I mean, what do you expect?
Well, no, I mean, I just, like, I see the like, there's, I think there's more at stake in the present age. And she's often invited on television to speak about the current president, Barack Obama. And she's basically being asked, using the setup of her Lincoln book, to cast Obama essentially in the same light as this transformative, very important president who, against all odds, will get great things done. And the, you know, the other message of her books is that, you know, there's a certain body count that's tolerable for great progress.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So, not tolerable, necessary.
Well, I mean, you know, as far as what she's saying.
I know. She says, no, it's necessary.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I get what you mean.
It has been necessary to kill millions of people for progress.
Sure. And she won't say that directly, but that's the message that, and it's not even that she completely glosses over it, you know, which would be maybe less egregious, but her effort to, she knew LBJ, because, you know, her husband, actually, no, I don't think she knew her husband then, but she was like a young girl and he brought her into, she was critical of the Vietnam War and LBJ brought her in to be like some kind of special, assistant, and she knew him very well. So she tries to tell this humanizing story about him that, oh, he was a conflicted man. And I don't know if that has value or not, or the consequences of what she does outweigh that.
You know, I don't know. I mean, she like David McCullough,
yeah,
like Joseph Ellis, the people on the top of the bestseller list. I mean, they write great man history. Again, they see the world from inside Washington, D.C. Like, that's where they see it from. They see, they're like, it's like they're standing in the Oval Office and they're looking at the world from, you know, through those windows in the Oval Office. And so the thing is, So there's that merger of their identity with political power, you know, with, in particular, the American nation state, you know, that they've merged their identities with it, right?
That's
really important. See, that's a really important concept. People need to understand that. Like, and that's what I, that's one of the things I really like about libertarians. They are cynical toward government. They are cynical toward political power. They don't ever say we or think we, you know, bombed the kids in Yemen. It's they did it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's like crucial. I mean, to me, that's like, that is the thing between standing between us and totalitarianism. I mean, so it's a, you know, it's a cult of personality. It's a merger of one's identity with the head of state. It's, you know, it's the root of totalitarianism. I mean, yeah.
But just back to,
it's not that interesting to me. I mean, but that, there's no question that that's what they do. They're not, you know, by the way, I mean, one of the reasons I'm a little bit dismissive of this is that not, I mean, just that it's not that interesting to me is that it's Kearns Goodwin and Ellis and McCullough are not taken seriously in the historical profession.
So right.
Yeah. I mean, like professional historians for the most part, even the total liberal, you know, types who agree with their politics don't consider them to be important or worthy of respect. So it's not like terribly threatened by them. I don't think they're that much of a problem. I mean, they're very popular and that kind of history is popular.
Sure. Here's the thing though, right? We were talking about market forces and demand before, and these people are bestsellers, right? So they're driving cultural perceptions. And what I think, you know, tell me, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, is people will read Renegade History of the United States. And they'll go, they'll flip the pages and they'll go, oh, holy shit. Oh, that's gross. Oh, I hope that's not true. Oh, yikes. You know, people, I think, and maybe it comes from, you know, more puritanical or even just basic Christian, you know, lens through which they view the world of there's a creator and there's a supreme power. They want things to be neat and clean. Like, hi, I'm in charge. Is you got a problem? I can solve it. And like, oh, Lincoln did this, FDR did this, LBJ gave us civil rights. And people say, oh, okay, I understand. It's nice and neat and simple. It has an appeal.
Yeah, well, I mean, some people simply want a strong father figure.
Right.
Okay, well, some people think sex is icky. you know, I mean, some people want to live in a very orderly environment, but that they value order more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
More than freedom or spontaneity, you know? So what are you going to do? I mean, I can't really, like, it's like dealing with Sean Hannity. What am I going to do with that person? I mean, I can't convince them to value something else. You know, I can't convince them to value freedom and spontaneity. I can't convince them to dislike, regimentation. So all I can do is identify, find people in the world who share my values. And then show them a politics that will fulfill those values. That's what I'm about. That's what I'm doing. I can't worry about people who are, you know, genuinely committed to a puritanical, regimented life.
Mm-hmm.
Can't. Who are genuinely committed to that. What I can do is identify people who, you know, like sex. They like leisure. They like fun. They're ashamed of it, maybe. But they like it. So the first thing is to sort of say to them, hey, why are you ashamed of it? You're ashamed of it because the culture has told you to be ashamed of it, not because there's anything naturally shameful about it. Your world has told you that. Here's the evidence. Here is 100 or 200 years of history, 200 years of a culture telling you to hate your desires for sex and freedom and leisure and fun.
Right.
So now you can be free of the idea that those things are naturally shameful. There's nothing naturally shameful about them. These are social constructions, that they're bad things. And then here's a politics that will free you to pursue those pleasures. And that politics includes a limited state or no state.
Mm-hmm.
The politics really very fundamentally includes disassociating with political power. Do not seek political power and do not identify with it. See it always as, at best, a necessary evil. At best, a necessary evil. Do not seek to replace it. Do not seek a revolution, because if you do that, you will then become the boss. You will then become puritanical. You will then have to force people to discipline themselves. It's the necessity of, it's a necessary part of holding political power. You must, governments must seek order. Their interest is primarily social order and social control. So that's what I can do. I mean, the people who really value living like good Germans in the 1930s, you know, I can't, what am I going to say? That's not, you should not value that. How far am I going to get with that argument?
Right. That's something that runs much deeper to the core of somebody's being. You know, for so long, I just said, you know, I looked at people out there, like the people that I was arguing with, and I said, oh my goodness, I've identified an information deficit that I can fill with information and make changes. And that never happens.
Right. And so then, and then it's, you know, people who really are like that, you know, like the Taliban today, mm-hmm. Like Christian evangelicals in our country, we're never going to convince them to, you know, to embrace sexual freedom, for instance, right?
Right?
We're never going to. And you know what? It comes down to this. The only thing we can do is leave them alone until they try to impose their values on us. And hey, then it comes down to guns. Seriously. Yeah. I mean, that's it. Like, until they do that, leave them alone. When they do that, you and I, we have to pick up guns. Seriously. I mean, that's it.
So you don't think, I mean, everyone is, it's like, I said this before and you corrected me. I used the word everyone and I was wrong. Certain people are vying for control of institutions that can do that today. Obviously, school is the biggest prize, but the political state is right there too.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, so, I mean, I can't take up a gun against my son's school.
No, of course not. But, you certainly can't.
But I can take up psychological guns, which is what I do, right? Again, it's like, I don't look at Toby's school as, you know, well, it's generally a well-meaning institution. Well, it's, you know, they may not execute their intentions properly, always properly, but, you know, the idea behind it, it's basically, no, it's fucking bad from the beginning. The conception of the goddamn thing is bad. The conception of it from Horace Mann onward was to discipline him, break him like a horse, make him into a worker and a soldier. That's what its intention was and is.
Right.
So I am hostile to that goddamn thing and oppositional to it. Now, does that mean I, you know, think he will get nothing at all from the school? I mean, I suppose he's learned how to read kind of and write kind of from it and do math a little bit from it. Okay, that's fine. We'll use that. You know, prisons give you 3 square meals a day too.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take that. We'll take the meals. Does that mean that the prison is in our interest? No, of course not. But no one ever thinks, oh, the warden is my family. The warden is on my side. He's part of it. No, he's not. Of course not. Ask a prisoner. You know, we should have the same attitude towards schools as prisoners do to their fucking wardens. You know, I mean, that's what it is. It's no different.
Right.
Sorry. I mean, that's, you know, that's what their intention is. In some ways, it's worse because at least, you know, in most prisons, they're not, well, some prisons don't put much into trying to train them to be workers and soldiers, although some do. But that's the intention of schools, is to train our children to be workers and soldiers.
Well, sir, that was a fast and furious hour there.
yeah, what else is new?
Yeah, we could call that a wrap.
All right, sounds good.
All right, thanks again, Thaddeus. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Brett. See ya.
Bye.
Guess who's back, back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Now everyone report to the dance floor. To the dance floor. To the dance floor. Now everyone report to the dance floor. All right, stop.
All right, if you're just joining us, welcome to our news roundup, final hour information overload hour. Before we get to our other stories of the day, reminder, our top story remains how the CBO projected that Obamacare will reduce the total number of hours Americans work by the equivalent of 2.3 million full-time jobs, which is basically in an opening into the soul of liberalism, where they are truly celebrating out there the fact that Obamacare is going to shrink the workforce by all these positions, and they think creating dependency, because otherwise people will lose their subsidy. Their government subsidy is a good thing. Anyway, here for our news roundup, information overload hour, we have Horace Cooper is with us. He's an adjunct fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research, co-chair of Project 21, the National Advisory Board, and Thaddeus Russell, author of A Renegade History of the U.S., professor of history, American Studies at Occidental College.
All right. So before we go through this, I think the problems with the next 20 minutes are going to be pretty apparent to most of you, but there's a couple of things that I think we should focus on as we listen to this. At this point, you've heard Thaddeus Russell talk on School Sucks podcast alone for about 2.5 hours. You might have watched his interviews on Stossel. You could have seen some of his videos or read some of his articles on Reason, and you could have even read or listened to the audiobook of A Renegade History of the United States. So you have some idea of the depth of his knowledge at this point. As you listen to this unfold, this segment over the next 20 minutes, ask yourself the question, or try to measure how much of that knowledge is able to pierce this particular format of mainstream media. Now, Sean Hannity, he wouldn't call himself mainstream media. He thinks he's the alternative media. He thinks he's the renegade answer to the establishment. And, you know, unfortunately, this is what most people are getting, and that's something that we need to keep in mind. So think about, just from what you've heard so far, what is lost through this media format. All right, God bless us. Here we go.
Welcome, Bob. Well, you're a big liberal, Thaddeus, so I assume you like the idea that as soon as we're going to have fewer hours, fewer workers, more people dependent on government, and a disincentive to work because their subsidies will run out. You got to love this as a lib.
God, I don't know where you got your information about me. I hate liberals even more than you do, Sean.
Oh, they're not left-wing enough for you. Let me get it right.
No. No, I'm more of the libertarian type. So
yeah.
I actually see the social safety net as more of a trap.
Well, good then. So you agree with me?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I think it actually has worked against the poor for many, many years. I think that government officials have been in the homes of people who are poor because of the social welfare system. And I think so that it's really served to function as a trap for many poor people.
No. What do you think, Horace?
Well, I do think that this particular CBO finding reveals what many people have thought for a long time. The Obama administration, through a number of its policies, has gone directly after the heart of the American work ethic. Right now, it's taking the most vulnerable in the community. He already promises that if you're a high-income earner, that we should be punished for being that. And he has come up with programs to get people addicted on the lowest end. But if you've decided to ignore free disability assistance and extended unemployment assistance and other kinds of goodies that he's been handing out and are working and struggling just over the poverty line, he now has a new way to get you captured and decide it just doesn't make sense. Work mm-hmm. is hard. Work is often unpopular, and you actually need incentive to work, not this huge incentive that tells people they shouldn't. This is going to be very bad.
All right, let me move on, because this is our roundup hour, and let me move to Chris Matthews over at NBC News. Now, NBC News, recent public policy polling shows that they are the least trusted news source in the country, Fox number one. Anyway, here's Matthews saying that any Republican in a room that says the president should be executed, you pile on and say, yeah, he's an outlaw. Now listen to this.
The continual statement that gets you where you want to go in right-wing Republican politics, and it's almost the same thing now, is simply always being against the president. Somebody in a room says the president ought to be executed, you pile on and say, yeah, he's an outlaw. Anything that's nasty, all the president's screwing the economy, he's costing jobs. Anything that's nasty about this guy is now become the amen chorus of the Republican Party. You can't ever put your hand up like John McCain did wondrously. Remember? And he said, no, he's a good man, when the woman said he's an Arab. Not that that's a bad thing, but she meant it as a bad thing. He said, no, he's a good American. When's anybody else going to do that? Is that like something you don't do anymore in the Republican Party? Say, wait a minute, hold your horses. We disagree on policy, but he's not the frickin' devil.
All right, so just more madness from NBC, destroying the brand of NBC News. Now, Thaddeus, by the way, the reason I said you're a liberal, I saw your tweet today that said you're going to convince me to become a left libertarian. So I just assumed that meant you're a lefty.
Well, in certain ways. I mean, so for anyone who believes in liberty and freedom, which I think you do, and the Founding Fathers certainly did, you should be hostile to government power no matter who holds it.
Thaddeus, if you listen to this program, I am a staunch advocate of limited government. All right, what did you think of that Chris Matthews clip?
I think it's terrific. I dislike Chris Matthews and MSNBC and their kowtowing to the government more than you do, perhaps, as I did with Bush and Republicans and GOP people during that time as well. If you are for limited government, freedom, and liberty, you should oppose the president no matter who he is.
You know, Horace...
I don't agree with that.
If there's a good president, you support them. If they have good policies, you support them. If somebody's limiting government, cutting taxes, and well, either that or you believe in anarchy if you don't want any government at all. I mean, this broad...
As a matter of fact, these guys named Thomas Jefferson and James Madison said we should always be hostile to government.
Thomas Jefferson was the president of the United States. He was the author of the Declaration. He was himself a president. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be suspicious of government, vigilant against government and its insatiable appetite to grow and for power in the bureaucracy. But there are good people that do good things sometimes.
Sean, let me say this. I like you, I'm not a member of this nihilist brigade that simply says anybody who exercises any authority whatsoever, I just oppose them on principle. We obviously look at the policies that are occurring, and we can criticize those that we disagree with, and we are enthusiastic about the ones we support. What I look at Chris Matthews, and when I say that, I mean euphemistically, because apparently nobody actually is, but when I do, I ask myself, where was he when the overwhelming progressive community was criticizing President Bush with these weirdo chants, Bush lied, people died? Now, we've got a lie. You can keep your own policy. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. Guess what? The president lied, and in fact, it's likely, as the LA Times and a number of these stories are reporting, people will be dying. Where is Chris Matthews on reporting that?
Well, they're not
going
to report that. I mean, he's so blinded now by his ideology and his worship of Obama that here's what's very troubling to me is that we, every American, whether you like, dislike, agree, disagree, I think any reasonable person knows that it is of the utmost importance. We have got to keep our elected officials safe.
Absolutely.
Now, hang on. So on MSNBC now, you have Ed Schultz saying, I think there's Republicans out there want this president to be shot. Then you got Chris Matthews saying that any Republican that says the president should be executed, you pile on and say, yeah, he's an outlaw. Nobody thinks this way. Nobody feels this way. No conservative would ever want something that evil to happen. But yet this is how this caricature, it's gone from throwing grandma over the cliff. It's gone from wanting to poison the air and water and hating children and having them fend for themselves with autism and Down syndrome to now that conservatives want something horrible to happen to the leader of the free world. That is beyond the pale. This is right up there, in my view, with Melissa Harris Perry. It's right up there with that idiot Martin Bashir wanting to the defecation and urination in Sarah Palin's mouth. This brand of NBC, who's going to stop this madness?
I have no respect for Chris Matthews, and I have criticized Obama since I first heard about him. But you must admit that there are some people, not the majority of conservatives, but there are some who do oppose him for the wrong reasons.
I don't even understand that concept.
That has nothing to do with what his comment was about here.
I'm not going to even concede this. If you're telling me in a nation of 300 million, there's not one person who's unfair, yeah, I agree that there's some people that are unfair. But it's not accurate to say that the leaders of the conservative movement go out of their way to find, quote, unfair. The frank truth is this president has given a lot of good and fair and open reasons to oppose him. It's his thin skin that says any criticism.
All right, but I want to drag you both back to the issue. You're missing the point, both of you. I want to get this. This is really, really important. Every night on Hannity, on the TV show, I wear a Secret Service pin. because I really love and admire these guys. I've gotten to meet many of them. They're willing to take a bullet for our elected officials, and these are brave men that put their lives on the line. Their job is crucial to the survival of this country, and that is the peaceful transition of power. The left has gotten so angry and so bizarre with their false narrative and caricature of the right and of conservatism that this is what it's now evolved into. And I'm saying, where does any of this end?
Well, Sean, I agree with you that there's been false characterizations of conservatives that all of us as a nation agree that our model is the model that's the exemplar for the world. We want to perpetuate mm-hmm. that. And we're robust in our discussions and our disagreements, but none of it means that we wish to engage in violence or in any way desire some evil outcome. Now, I've looked at a number of these high-profile, bad, tragic incidents that occurred, and the MSNBCs of the world quickly come out and try to pretend that it's a Sean Hannity watcher or viewer that was somehow associated with it, and increasingly the evidence shows it's just the opposite. I'm not tarnishing all of the left with that. I'm just saying, why is this predisposition to say that conservatives, the people that honor the founders, the people that honor the nation, are somehow desperately hoping for terrible things to happen to this
It's just
country.
Crazy. All right, now let me move on here because we got other stories we got to check in with here today. Now, the Olympic opening ceremonies are tomorrow night, and Todd Lodwick is the U.S. flag bearer. And Yahoo Sports had an interesting piece today where, in fact, he's going to round the track of the stadium on Friday night. He's going to pass the section of the stand where Vladimir Putin is situated. He'll be a few inches away and potentially could break the law, because if Lodwick decides to copy many other nations and follow the typical Olympic protocol of dipping the flag to Putin or any other watching head of state as a sign of respect, he'd be in direct conflict with a genuine, real, but little known U.S. federal law, which is Chapter 1, Title 4, U.S. Code, which forbids the stars and stripes to be dipped to any person or thing. I hope he doesn't dip. Reaction, Thaddeus.
Well, I mean, so merging one's identity with a nation state has always been a hallmark of totalitarian societies. I don't know why we would want to support that kind of thing. That kind of culture leads to a diminution of freedom, the kinds of things that conservatives claim to be about. If you look at countries in which people have given themselves over to the flag, to the nation state,
there'll
be no freedom whatsoever. So moving in that direction seems to be not to be something that we should be for.
I can't disagree with that any more vigorously than I do. Here's the fact.
Good.
When you are representing your country and you understand what people expect to see, what they see as respect, and you do the opposite of that, it doesn't matter whether that's the legal issue or not. It would be highly disrespectful, and frankly, I would hope that no American would ever want to be watched by an international audience disrespecting other Americans or our country. So no, I don't want them to dip the flag.
No dipping the flag.
I will not feel disrespected. I will never feel disrespected if anyone disrespects the American flag.
Well, you know what?
That bothers me.
Bothers me,
feel
too.
Feel free to hold that view.
Yeah, let me tell you, you know why, and you can argue all you want that it's symbolic, but I'm going to tell you something. This happened after 9/11. I was called, flag wavers like Sean Hannity. How many people fought, lost limbs?
Absolutely.
Suffered greatly, sacrificed greatly, some died fighting for that flag and all it represents. This is not just some piece of cloth. This is the symbol of liberty and freedom around the world. This is it, because we are the world's last, best, greatest hope, period. But moving on. All right. I love this court decision. It's out of St. Louis. Judge ruled that if a driver is flashing their lights to warn other drivers that a speed trap is there, it is protected free speech. I love this judge. Judge's name is Henry Autry of St. Louis, ruled the driver has the right to flash their lights under the First Amendment. I'm like, amen, hallelujah. I flash all the time, and it's my freedom of speech to warn people of these crappy traps that are set up just to nail people and get a little more money out of their pocket. Reaction, Thaddeus, Mr. Liberal, left-leaning libertarian.
I have converted you to being a left libertarian, Sean. I'm so proud of myself.
You haven't convinced me of one thing yet, but go ahead.
Well, no, of course I'm all for this. I mean, this is a terrible encroachment on our freedom. It's by the state, and I'm all for people, but for ordinary citizens having the power to check that power. Of course.
Well, I think we might all come down on the same side on this, but I think it's coming down on the freedom side, and that is the idea that these assessments are being done just for revenue purposes and actually not for much safety. And if individuals help other people to recognize that they're not in compliance with the law and they slow down in time and they avoid in this particular recessionary period a ticket that they can ill afford, I'm saying hallelujah to that. I think that's a great thing. And the police should be encouraging others to do this rather than actually hassling them with an arrest.
All right, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you all for being with us. And, oh, by the way, you guys need to get – do you have a girlfriend, Thaddeus? Do you have a wife? Do you have a girlfriend, Horace? Do you have a wife?
Not married yet.
I do.
All right. Well, you have a girlfriend?
You want to
hand me? I can't – listen, Hannah Date went away a while ago, so I can't help you. But here's the deal. You do have special women in your lives, both of you, right?
Yeah.
All right. You've got to send the best. You've got to wow that woman in your life. And Valentine's Day is next week, so you better get your – you better get your shine on, and you better get ready, and you better be able to wow her. And the best way to do it, guys, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, and you get the best of the best roses. They are your rose authority. And the only way I send roses, you get the best quality roses. They last the longest, the greatest value, and I send them to my wife regularly, and they're absolutely stunning and beautiful. And because you guys were both on the program, and Thaddeus failed today at converting me,
I don't think so.
I will give both of you a 1-800-Flowers.com gift certificate for the women in your lives, okay?
Excellent.
So you don't screw up this year.
But excellent. Thanks, you're the man.
All right. So guys out there, listen, this is a limited time offer just for you, my listeners. It's only available till tomorrow at midnight. If you order 2 dozen beautiful multicolored roses, you'll get them for $29.99. 2 dozen for her. For Valentine's Day. She's going to be doubly happy. That's $30 off the regular price. Now, you can't beat this deal. $29.99, 24 beautiful roses. Go to 1-800-Flowers.com. This offer ends Friday, only while supplies last. You got to order right now. Don't wait to wow her and make her day. Make her happy because of all the things she does for you. Just go to 1-800-Flowers.com. Use your desktop, your mobile device. Click on the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Put in my last name, Hannity. 1-800-Flowers.com. Put in my name, Hannity, or call 1-800-Flowers, and you will be a rock star. You will be a hero. You will be appreciated. She will love you for it. 1-800-Flowers or 1-800-Flowers.com for her because you're a great guy.